The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
For next week, I want you to hand in a brief outline of John. But if you'll notice, in the second paragraph of the syllabus, I'm asking you there, the second sentence, I want you to read through the Gospel of John twice in two different English versions, to do that this first week. And then on the basis of that reading, you are to hand in a one-page outline, but also one-page description of the author. Now, the outline is not supposed to be something detailed. I just want you to think about the basic structure of the gospel. I have my own outline that I'll be handing in at some point to you. But what I'm more interested in is that in your reading of the gospel, you begin to think about what do I learn about this author from what he has said in the gospel, how he has said it. Those are really two issues. The outline is a summary of contents, also a little bit more than that. I hope that in the outline you can maybe... The outline ought to reflect to some degree your understanding of the gospel, how the argument is developed, and so on. I'll be saying more about that. But the other part of the assignment isn't so much a matter of the contents of the gospel as to how the author comes across to you. Maybe in terms of his interests, in terms of the selection of the material. It's a little bit of an amorphous kind of assignment, and you're not going to be graded on this, but it's not a long thing. When I say one page description of the author, just a couple of paragraphs, tell me what you think you have learned about this person on the basis of the way he has put together this material. And I guess part of what I'm after here is to get you to move your attention a little bit from Jesus and the story being told in the gospel to the author's own perspective on Jesus and the story surrounding Jesus' life and so on. Hope that makes some sense. If not, you're not going to flunk out. It's just a little experiment to see what comes out of that. Then I also would like for you to read through this brief book by Robert Kaiser, John the Maverick Gospel, as an entree into mainstream scholarship on the fourth gospel. It's written at a fairly popular level, so you can go through it quickly. And I would like for you again to come up with a one-page evaluation of the book. Do you think that the book is well written? He's not an evangelical in our sense of the term, so he may make you a little bit upset about some of the things he says. Don't let that bother you too much. I'm more interested in the question of whether he has succeeded in explaining to you what are the issues that seem to motivate scholarship so far as both the origins of the gospel, what the theology of the book is, and that kind of thing. I'm not going to be asking you to read an awful lot in critical scholarship, at least not those of you taking it for the MDiv, MAR level, but this would at least give you a little bit of perspective on what is the usual critical handling of the gospel. But I think it's also a provocative book. I think it makes you think. And it seems to me that if fairly early on in the semester you can identify some of these rather critical questions, It can also be of help in terms of focusing on certain issues throughout the rest of the semester. Now, also beginning on the 22nd, you notice that we're going to be starting to deal with the text itself, chapter 1 of John. And what you're supposed to do is to prepare carefully that passage. Now, chapter 1 means here, beginning with verse 19, because we're going to leave the prologue for the very end of the semester. But if you could go through the Greek carefully, use Carson's commentary to help you with some of the material. Throughout the course of the semester, I would like for you to consult some of the standard commentaries, Barrett and Brown and so on, a few times during the semester to give you a little bit of an additional viewpoint on them. And you can see that I have scattered readings. On the 29th, Dodd's book, Interpreting the Fourth Gospel, there's a section there dealing with chapters 2 through 4 of John, actually, that could give you a nice flavor for Dodd's approach to the book. On March 21st, I would like for you to read a chapter in that book, Hearing the New Testament. This is a feminist interpretation of chapter 4. It's really very, very interesting, kind of well done. And I think chapter 4 of the Gospel of John has been a source of a great deal of discussion in modern scholarship. And I think the author, Schneider's, she's quite competent in terms of giving you a little bit of perspective on some of the questions that are being asked from reader response theory and other related approaches. Then you notice that papers for THM PhD students are due April 25th. You have a reading from Burge's book, Anointed Community, Chapter 3, and a reading from an article that appeared in the journal. The second page has the bibliography that these things are key to. You also notice that we have a quiz in a couple of weeks, March 7th, on John chapters 1 through 12. A few years ago, somebody in the class the first day, when I said it's chapters 1 through 12, somebody said, "Oh, I thought it was chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. And this person walked out of the class at that point. Anyway, chapters 1 through 12, and then the rest of the gospel right after spring vacation. So you have something to do down in Fort Lauderdale or wherever you go. These quizzes are not, you know, I give you a couple of passages and you translate and parse selected verbs and, you know, you have to prepare for them, but it shouldn't be a great source of stress. Let me think here. Oh, yeah. Toward the end of the second paragraph, say, moreover, the student is to choose one of those passages, that is, one of the passages that we're going to be covering during the semester, as a special research project, the results of which should be summarized in the final exam. What I have in mind here is an assignment in lieu of an actual paper where you do, as a matter of fact, do a little bit of special research on a project. I mean, you can look at it, if you will, as preparing to write a paper, but instead of actually writing a formal research paper, you take good notes, and in the final exam, you're going to tell me what you have learned on the basis of your study of the passage and the commentaries and so on. And I'll say more about that as the time approaches. If you're an MDiv or MAR student and you would like to do the THM PhD approach to it, let me know, and you know, we can work something out. Let me talk about that second page. I'm not going to read through this. You can do this on your own, and if you have any questions, we can discuss them maybe next week. But I would like THM and PhD students to familiarize themselves with some of these items that aren't reserved, particularly the book by Dodd, which I would like for you to read, read the whole thing. You can exercise a little bit of discretion as to how carefully you read each page, but I do want you to have a pretty good sense of what the whole book is about. The more interesting, and I think the more profitable material is when you get to the last major section of the book, in which he actually gives an exposition of the Gospel of John, which is unusually well done. But the earlier sections are also important. He deals with matters of the theological background of the Gospel of John and issues of that sort. I would also like to ask you to this first book in the list by John Ashton, Understanding the Fourth Gospel. It's a big fat book, very impressive in many ways. And the first part of the book, which consists of three chapters, something like before Bultmann, Bultmann, and after Bultmann, is a great history of research. And I would like for you to make sure that you do go through that and try to, you know, crystallize the major problems that have been dealt with in the past century or so. So the whole of Dodd's book, those first chapters in Ashton, and you know, most of the book by Birch also, I would like for you to familiarize yourself with. One advantage of the book by Birch is that it is a revision of his doctoral dissertation, and those of you thinking about writing a dissertation, you know, could use this as something of a model in terms of identifying topics and dealing with issues of research and so on. But it's also a very fine contribution from an evangelical scholar to the theology of the Gospel of John. The book by Martin Hengel and the book by Culpepper, I'm not going to ask for any specific reading there. Do please pull them out and spend, you know, half an hour or something. There may be some material in either or both of those books that you may be particularly interested in. Culpepper's book marks something of a watershed in the study of the Gospel of John, because it was the first really full-blown attempt to apply literary criticism to the Gospel of John. And it made quite an impact when it appeared. There are some people who take a less than positive viewpoint on this whole matter. For example, this fellow Ashton, he's more traditional in terms of you know, critical scholarship and the historical source critical issues and that kind of thing. And he has written a more recent book called Studying John, in which he really, well, he lets them have it. So far as people involved in modern literary criticism and narratology and so on, and he has very severe criticisms, including Culpepper. He thinks that there are some things there that don't really fit in a proper literary approach to the Gospel of John. But anyway, Culpepper's book, very significant because of the influence it has had. And the book by Martin Hengel, important for a somewhat different reason. Without accepting the apostolic authorship of the Gospel of John, he has taken a very critical approach to modern theories regarding the historical origins of the Gospel. And that book has made also something of a splash, and you ought to at least have some idea of what's going on there. The two articles that I have written, you don't really need to read either of those, but I will be talking about some of the material that is found in these articles, and if you want to just check out to see whether I'm saying the same thing that I wrote before or not, you're welcome to do that. And the last item by van der Vaart is a required reading of everybody at the end of the semester. So. Anyway, I'll let you reflect on this material. Any questions about the setup here. Okay. Let me begin. Anybody need a? Oh, all right. Go ahead.
Yes, the MDiv passages are being
restricted. Yeah, because one of the things that I would like for you to do is to interact with, you know, what is done in class. But if you have, you know, something that's just burning, you're burning to do it, let me know and we can work something out.
Are we going to have class on those 2 days that
we have a I'm glad you asked. On March 7th, I'm going to be out of town. But on April 11th, I will be here. The quiz shouldn't take more than, well, I don't know. At the very, very most, 45 minutes. So we'll have class after the quiz at the. All right. Let me talk a little bit about introductory issues with regard to the Gospel of John. And the first topic that I want to cover rather briefly is the Gospel of John in history. In other words, what's been happening for the past 2,000 years or so in as far as people's understanding of this book. You need to be aware of the fact that as far back as we can go in the second century, the external evidence supporting John's authorship, that is the Apostle John's authorship of the book, is really incontrovertible. It is about as strong and clear and consistent a set of attestation as we have for any other book of the New Testament. Even in the midst of serious controversy, because the Gospel of John was controversial, some of the heretics liked the Gospel of John because they were able to do certain things with it that they might not with other books. But even in the midst of the controversy surrounding Gnostic uses of the Gospel of John and so on, we find no shred of evidence for someone other than the Apostle John having written it. Now let me explain precisely what I mean by that. Every time someone says anything about the Gospel of John, the assumption seems to be that the Apostle John wrote it. There's no question that in the second century, it was assumed by most of the people that we can get some information from that the Apostle John had written it. But the point that I'm making is a little bit different from that, or it goes beyond it, namely, that no one ever suggested somebody else as the author. There was no controversy about who wrote the book that we can actually get our hands on. Even C.H. Dodd, who was not at all persuaded that the Apostle John had written this gospel, he said, of any external evidence to the contrary that could be called cogent, I am not aware. There's just nothing there except evidence in favor of the Johannine authorship of the gospel. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of this so that you see the kinds of things that we're talking about. Irenaeus, writing in the last third of the second century, in his book Against Heresies, book 3, chapter 11, that chapter begins with an argument that the Gospel of John was written to as an answer to the heresies of Cerinthus. But he starts out the chapter with a straight reference to John, and there's no suggestion whatever that this matter was disputed by anyone. You see, to me, that is very, very significant type of evidence, because you have to distinguish statements by the early fathers in which they argue for a particular author, which reflects some controversy about authorship. You have to distinguish between that and, on the other hand, an outright assertion without any indication that anybody's going to dispute it. You see, he's not arguing for the apostolic authorship of the gospel. He is taking it for granted and also assuming that nobody's going to dispute it when they read it. Similarly, in Book 3, Chapter 1, Paragraph 1, and incidentally, you might remember that Irenaeus claims to have had personal knowledge of Polycarp, who in turn, was supposed to have known the Apostle John. So that's Irenaeus. When you move about the same time period to Clement of Alexandria, he is also very straightforward. He says, last of all, John, that is, he's been talking about the other Gospels, he says, last of all, John, perceiving that the external facts, he uses the term ta somatica, that the external facts, perceiving that the external facts had been made plain in the synoptics, being urged by friends and inspired by the Spirit, composed a spiritual, pneumatikon, gospel. Now, you appreciate here that Clement is expressing an opinion about the character of the gospel, suggesting even a possible set of circumstances that explain the origin of the gospel, namely, the synoptics were around, they focused on tasomatika, the external facts of the history, and John had a different perspective, and he kept talking, giving his spiritual interpretation of the gospel, and people kept saying, you ought to write that down, I ought to write a book of this, And finally, he yielded to that pressure and composed a spiritual gospel. Clement's statement is quoted by Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History. Eusebius, Ecclesiastical History, 614. Now, Eusebius, you will recall, was writing more than a century later, the beginning of the 4th century, and his own statement about it, not when he's quoting Clement or anybody else, but his own statement is in 3:23 and 24 of his history, and it goes like this. When Mark and Luke had already published their Gospels, they say that John, they say means that he is bringing together the tradition. They say that John proceeded to write. John accepted the synoptics as truthful, but they lacked an account of Christ's deeds at the beginning of the ministry. Therefore, John records the deeds performed before the Baptist was cast into prison. Namely, in John 3:24, you have the statement about that, and so what comes before, particularly the wedding in Cana and Nicodemus and so on, that was missing from the synoptics. And so that's what John was interested in doing, supplementing the synoptics historically. Now, that's a somewhat different perspective from Clement's, who looks at it not so much in terms of supplementing them historically, but theologically. Well, the point is that from the earliest period, it was taken for granted not only that the Apostle John was the author of the fourth gospel, but that this gospel had special historical value, It was written by an eyewitness trying to supplement the synoptic material. And also that this gospel had a special theological value. So that complex of ideas, John is the author, it gives us some historical information that otherwise we wouldn't have, and it gives us a theological perspective that is distinctive. That complex of ideas was pretty much the accepted way of understanding the Gospel of John for many centuries. Things, of course, changed drastically in the 19th century. As early as around 1820, I think it was, a fellow by the name of Brett Schneider began to collect arguments that had been suggested here and there against the authenticity of the gospel. Now, right about that time, Schleiermacher wrote on the Gospel of John, and he had a more positive attitude toward the gospel, and that was rather influential. But not for long, because David Strauss came on the scene, and he dealt a pretty heavy blow to the credibility of the fourth gospel. A view, you could view that as a fairly new viewpoint, which was thought to be confirmed by the so-called Markan hypothesis. Now you remember that right about the middle of the 19th century, the idea that Mark may have been the first gospel to be written, that idea was proposed, and before too long it caught on. But the implication of that was that as the earliest gospel, it was also the most reliable. And if you look at the Gospel of Mark as the one that gives you the most basic historical material, that tends to aggravate the discussion with regard to the significance of the Gospel of John, which, you know, is so different from the Synoptics. And things necessarily are going to change, because if up to this point people would give a great deal of credence to John as an eyewitness, who, you know, he's particularly dependable historically, but now you say, no, Mark is the one that gives you the basic historical core, and then you see that the Gospel of John is so different. I mean, the very structure of the ministry of Jesus, the way Jesus speaks, the lack of parables, all of these things, that tended to make people less and less confident that the Gospel of John could be trusted historically. And so by the end of the 19th century, scholars quite commonly assumed that the fourth gospel was not written by an apostle at all, but rather was composed in the middle of the second century for strictly theological reasons, an attempt to present a particular viewpoint in the light of theological controversy during the second century. The Gospel of John began to be seen more and more as a Hellenistic document, as opposed to something having been produced by a Palestinian Jew. And of course, there was more and more discussion about the possible sources that might have been used by the evangelist. And that particular combination of ideas, a Hellenistic background, uses of sources, and so on, was brought to a climax by Rudolf Bultmann in his application of the history of religions approach. So by the time you get to the 1940s or whatever, Bultmann's work has become more or less the epitome of critical scholarship, viewing the Gospel of John, you know, just about as far from apostolic authority as one can imagine. Not written by a Jew at all, but by some Hellenist in Asia Minor, perhaps, deeply influenced by Gnostic ideas or what have you. Well, as by now is well known, a significant shift began to take place with the publication of Papyrus 52. Remember that little fragment, the Rylands fragment, which contained just a couple of verses from John chapter 18, a couple of verses on one side and a couple of other verses on the other side. And paleographical analysis of the document made it clear that that particular papyrus must have been written on, must have been composed around the year 125-130, very, very unlikely to have been any later than the year 135. Almost overnight, that discovery led to some sort of revision of people's understanding of the origins of the Gospel of John. Because for such a text to be found in Egypt near the Nile River, the original copy of John must have been produced many years earlier. And so today, a date prior to the year 100 is almost universally held, even by the most radical critics. So that's factor number one in the revision of people's understanding of the Gospel of John, the discovery of Papyrus 52. A second factor contributing to a shift of attitude was the work of C.H. Dodd. Now, Dodd, again, was not an evangelical. From the point of view of American evangelicalism, he sounds pretty liberal. But over against the work of the German critics, he sounds almost fundamentalistic. And he wrote a couple of massive books on John. This one that I'm asking you to read parts of, Interpreting the Fourth Gospel, and another one, Historical Tradition and... what is it? Anyway, on the history, historical something of the Gospel of John. And in that book, he tried to show, using the presuppositions and methods of critical scholarship, that an awful lot in the Gospel of John gave every indication of ancient historical material, that you could not really attribute the composition of the Gospel as a whole to some Hellenist in the second century or whatever, coming up with his own ideas about what things might have been like or anything of the sort. Dodd, by the way, really quite a remarkable scholar in many respects. He was brought up in a very strict Calvinistic environment where it was thought very sinful to take a bath on Sunday, that kind of thing. And he never, even though he moved theological quite a bit, he never totally dissociated himself from some of that background. But his mastery of the original documents and his familiarity with primary sources in the ancient world and lots of other factors, we need to pay attention to his work. There is a story of one time a student kept noticing that Dodd would quote the New Testament passages in the original. In the course of a conversation, somebody might say, "Oh yeah," and as he responded to the conversation, he would quote some fairly lengthy passages in Greek. And one student once said to him, "Professor Dodd, do you have the whole New Testament memorized in Greek?" And Dodd kind of shook his head and said, "Well, I guess I do." Anyway, his work made quite an impact, and people had to reorient themselves with regard to how they were understanding the historical data and the gospel. And the third factor, as you probably know, was the discovery of the Qumran documents, because all of a sudden you have these texts that no one can dispute. You cannot interpret them as, well, this is a process of tradition or whatever. These are the actual texts of the first century. And you have vocabulary and phraseology and points of view that correspond to some extent with the very things in the Gospel of John which Bultmann had identified as Hellenistic features, particularly, you know, the dualistic terminology of light and darkness and a number of other details in the Gospel. And now you could see incontrovertible proof of Palestinian sources reflecting very similar ways of speaking and cultural and ideological correspondences. The result of these factors was what J.A.T. Robinson decided to call the new look on the fourth gospel. This is a term that became very popular in the late 50s, early 60s, the new look on the fourth gospel, which indicated a rather significant shift of outlook in the way in which contemporary scholarship was looking at the fourth gospel. You want to be careful about how far you take that. The new look on the fourth gospel does not mean a return to apostolic authorship by any means, or to complete historicity, nothing like that. But it is a general viewpoint that allows for the strong possibility that there is genuine Johannine tradition lying behind the gospel. Genuine Johannine tradition lying behind the gospel. None of the really prominent Johannine scholars like Barrett and Brown and so on would agree that John the Apostle was the actual author. But they recognize that there may be some connection, some genuine connection between the writing of the gospel and the tradition connected with the Apostle John. And even if they don't go that far, at least they recognize that the narrative probably reflects some historical material going much further back than had been allowed by previous scholars. Now, the term the Johannine tradition, or what has become even more common nowadays, the Johannine community, that has now become the pivotal issue for most scholars of the fourth gospel. And quite a few people in the field have been devoting their energies to reconstructing the historical situation at the end of the first century, which may have given rise to the Gospel of John. And in fact, people who are really excited about that find it unspeakably boring when some of us raise the question about, you know, what Jesus was actually doing or thinking or what was going on in the ministry of Jesus or what John or the author may have preserved from the past. That's, I mean, who wants to know about that? What's really exciting is how the Gospel of John now becomes a source to figure out what were the needs and interests and concerns of Christians, presumably around Ephesus, in the last decades of the first century. Unfortunately, and by the way, let me give you just one example of this that will come up later. J. Lewis Martin, is a fellow who has been particularly influential in this respect. He made a great deal out of his view that the Gospel of John gives you this twofold perspective. There's the historical, the ostensible historical setting in Jesus' day, but as a matter of fact, the real interest of the Gospel is the setting in the day in which the author lived, namely the end of the first century. And he went looking for stuff that might reflect what was happening at the end of the first century. And he came to the conclusion, particularly when you look at chapter 9 of the Gospel of John, the story of the blind man, who you will recall is excommunicated from the synagogue. To him, this was a very, very important bit of information because he claimed that you could not find any evidence of excommunication prior to the Council of Jamnia or whatever at the end of the first century. Therefore, the story of the blind man and his healing and his being excommunicated and so on really reflects a new situation arising in the 90s or whatever. And that's what the Gospel is really telling you about. And it does not really tell you anything about the 30s of the first century, but about the new conflicts that have been developing as a result of the antithesis between Judaism and Christianity. Now, it's very unfortunate, I began to say, that these two elements, Johannine authorship on the one hand, and an emphasis on the so-called community of the beloved disciple. Now, these two things have become very antithetical. People who focus on the historical situation at the end of the century more or less automatically assume that, therefore, the apostolic authorship of the Gospel is an irrelevant question anyway. Almost certainly untrue, but even if it were true, it's irrelevant. On the other side, those who insist on the apostolic authorship of the Gospel of John tend to minimize the kinds of research that have been going on with respect to this supposed community. I think a good example of this is Don Carson himself in his commentary, where he has an excellent, I think, an excellent defense of apostolic authorship, of John's authorship. But then, as he comes to the conclusion of that section, he says, well, now, what significance does this have? Well, that you really shouldn't be wasting your time trying to reconstruct the community of the beloved disciple or whatever at the end of the first century. And actually, I think that's unfortunate, because the fact that John is the author, or the probability that he's the author, remember that the Gospel is anonymous. You know, it doesn't actually make a claim that John wrote it. I think he did for a variety of reasons. But the fact that he did does not exclude another set of facts, namely that he is living and ministering in a situation many years after the work of Christ, that his own ministry and the kinds of problems that he would have faced would probably affect his own understanding, as well as his preaching, if you will, of the story of Jesus and of his teachings. As I said, I'm not going to go over the arguments for the apostolic authenticity of the Gospel, although I do want to make this point, which I don't see it emphasized as much as it ought to. Those who deny the Johannine authorship of the Gospel of John have no cogent answer to the problem that John the Apostle is not actually mentioned in the Gospel. That simple fact. It's an amazing thing to me how many scholars simply ignore that problem. The only answer that has even a measure of plausibility but which I think in the end is a very lame argument, frankly, is the response that says, well, but the author and the reader had no knowledge of the synoptics, and so there's nothing strange about the omission. Now, that's another set of issues that we'll be saying a little bit about. Did John know the synoptics or not? You know, it's a complicated question. But frankly, it is, whatever you think about the issue of literary dependence, it is totally unreasonable to suppose that any Christian community at the end of the first century wouldn't have known that John, along with Peter and James, was an intimate disciple of Jesus. And for somebody to write a gospel talking about the story of Jesus and not mention John, whereas Peter is, you know, mentioned frequently, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Unless it was John who wrote the book and people knew that he was the one who wrote it, and he subtly identifies himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, which incidentally is not a pretentious title, as some people say, and you know, it's unimaginable that somebody would have had the gall to call himself the beloved disciple. But that's not it at all. It is, in fact, one way of acknowledging one's humility. You know, imagine that Jesus loved me, kind of thing. But that, to me, is one of the combination of the external testimony for the Johannine authorship of the gospel and the omission of any reference to John, along with some other features, but those two things in particular, I think are very, very strong arguments in favor of Johannine authorship. But I don't want to make the mistake, which I think it's a mistake, of therefore not paying any attention to other features about the Gospel of John, which may indeed reflect the newer, more recent situation in which the author would have found himself. My own theoretical construct of all that's going on here is that over the years, John developed a particular style of talking about the gospel and the coming of Jesus and his teaching. And like any good preacher, you know, he would have integrated to some degree his own personality with what he was preaching. And that preaching and that recollection of the stories and that particular viewpoint and interpretation was something quite distinctive that people who had only an acquaintance with the standard, you know, narrative that you find in the synoptics would have found, hey, that's really something, you know. And I do suspect that maybe people did say, you know, you really ought to write this down. This is kind of a new approach to things or a different perspective that really helps us appreciate what was going on in a way that we hadn't thought about before. So he sits down to write this gospel, knowing about the synoptics and wanting to do something a little bit different. And the differences between the synoptics and the Gospel of John are not coincidental. It's that John wants to present material that people would not have otherwise known about, and to do it in the way in which he has become accustomed. And I think that's the reason why the style. You remember the problem, for instance, in chapter 3, where Jesus is speaking, and then if you look at the translations, some people put the end of the quotation marks in one place, and others put it in another place, and there's some controversy. Now, where do Jesus' words end and John's comments begin? The very fact that there's a problem with that tells you, now this is a little strange, because Jesus speaks in the same style that John writes his narrative, you see. And I think that's what's going on to a large extent. It is John's own paraphrasing, his own representing of what Jesus had taught. He's not trying to, you know, pull the wool over anybody's eyes or be inaccurate or non-dependable. He's assuming that people already know the story, and now he is retelling it in a way that is distinctive to his own inspired understanding of the life and teachings of Christ. Well, so much for this summary of the way that people have been looking at the Gospel of John. We will be coming back to some of these issues in different ways as we look at specific portions of the text. But do you have any questions up to this point? Yeah. Well, you know, paleographers over the course of time have developed a number of criteria. Whenever they find something, they need to come up with a way of updating the, not just in biblical studies, it's in any field. And there's a whole bunch of things to consider. The style of the writing, the kind of ink used, sometimes the shapes of the letters. There's a whole range of things. And when you have a pretty extensive set of data, you do see rather clear patterns in the way in which the handwriting develops and other features of that sort. And using standard paleographical criteria, it seemed very improbable that that particular text would have been written any later than the year 135. But I wouldn't be able right now to tell you what specifically is there about the shape of the letters or whatever that would distinguish it from some of the later developments of the script. Sometimes, you know, it may involve an actual chemical analysis of the ink used and other features.
Sir, who was it you said came with the phrase that you love?
John A.T. Robinson. You may be aware of the fact that Robinson, toward the end of his life, took things even further, and he's the one who came up with the idea that every book of the New Testament was written prior to A.D. 70, which was kind of an extreme position and rather ironic since he basically belonged to the mainstream of higher critical scholarship. But where do I start on that one? I'm sorry. There have been a number of scholars who have argued that certain books of the New Testament were originally written in Aramaic instead of Greek. And the Gospel of John, like the Gospel of, actually every Gospel at one point or another has been, the suggestion has been made that it was written either Hebrew or Aramaic. There was a scholar earlier in the century named De Bernay who tried to demonstrate by, the way this works is you look at certain turns of expression that maybe can be best explained as the Greek having been translated from Aramaic. Sometimes the argument is that there is a mistranslation of an Aramaic source. Scholarship as a whole was never persuaded in any significant way by Bernie's arguments. There have been some recent scholars in the past 10 or 15 years, a couple of them anyway, who have tried to revive that as well. And as far as I can tell, they haven't gone anywhere. And I suppose the main reason is that even though they appear to collect a significant number of examples supporting their idea, none of the examples is provable. You know, you have to have an awful lot of confidence in your ability to imagine what you know the previous language would have been, and so on. So it doesn't seem to be working at all. And it would also go against, you know, whatever information we have of an external source, either from early tradition or textual evidence of any kind. I'm talking about manuscript evidence, what have you. Okay, I want to take another 15 or 20 minutes and I'll let you go. But I wanted to say something about the text of the Gospel of John. Apart from Papyrus 52, which is very significant for historical reasons, but which is of no help in reconstructing the text because it's just a couple of verses, so what can you do with it? But apart from Papyrus 52, our oldest
source is Papyrus 66, which is dated, again using paleography, no later than the beginnings of the 3rd century, possibly earlier. And so most people say about the year 200. Papyrus 66 is one of the famous papyri in the Bodmer collection. And this one was published in the mid-50s. Now, here's a reproduction of Papyrus 66, chapter 5. And if you have your Greek New Testaments, how many of you have your Greek Testaments here? Well, you might want to look at chapter 5 of John and do a little bit of textual collation here to see what kinds of differences appear among the manuscripts. The very beginning here, let's pick it up. Chapter 5, verse 3 begins right here. In tautais, I realize that some of these letters just you can't see at all because of the reproduction here. But if you compare with your text, you find that that's what your text will have also. In tautais, then you have this verb kate keita. There was lying down there. Plethos, a crowd. Tone, as, remember that C is really the sigma in unctual writing. As the nun tone of those who were ill or sick or whatever. To flown, the blind, colon, lame, and so on. Seron. Then you begin here, verse 5, because it skips here. You have an early, very early document which supports the view that the rest of verse 3 and verse 4 in the King James Version is a later addition, the matter of the angel troubling the water kind of thing. So you move straight to verse 5. That's significant enough here. Tis eke anthropos. Now, do you see any difference what your text says? Eke and anthropos are inverted. Eke anthropos. Now, this is a very common textual variation. As you can tell, it makes absolutely no difference on the meaning of the text. There was a man there. There was there a man. What's the big deal? No big deal at all. It's transpositions of this sort occur very, very frequently. Then you have another transposition with the, here you have ete, years, which comes after the actual number 38. The number 38 is just the two letters, lambda and eta, with the line on top. So using the letters to indicate a number. echon, having 38 years, in te asthenia, in his sickness. In his sickness, yeah, too. And then you have the next sentence, tuton, eidon, actually it is this is the participle, eidon. This is not a textual variation as such, it's just an orthographic difference. The epsilon with the iota very frequently interchanges with the iota by itself. Jesus, then ho Jesus, Jesus seeing him, katakemenon, kai gnus, lying there, and knowing, haughty, polun. And then you have this adverb eide has been written in between the two lines because he left it out when he wrote, and he probably he himself noticed it, and then put it in between the lines. Already he had been there much time. Eke chronon. Here's the eke. And then you have a little bit more information here. Trying to look for another interesting variation. Don't want to take too much time on this, but well, I don't find it now. There were a couple of other things here that might be of some use as well. But I wanted just to go through a couple of verses so that you would see what are the kinds of variations that are frequently found as you begin to compare manuscripts. And as a rule, you see that they are of this sort, either orthographic things that matter not at all, various kinds of transpositions that also do not affect the meaning of the text. In some cases, you might argue, well, perhaps it affects slightly the nuance or the emphasis of the sentence. The other important manuscript that you may want to that you will want to be familiar with is Papyrus 75, which is a little bit more difficult to read, and you probably can't tell almost at all. But let me see if I can find. Here's verse 3. In tau tais katekeita, and so on. And the basic text again is the same. Some very minor variations, particularly going through this passage. Just to give you a little bit of a summary of, if you could flip the light, just for my own benefit, I was doing a little bit of collation of this chapter, verses 1 to 23. In Papyrus 66, I found about 24 variations in those 23 verses. But as I have mentioned, most of these were orthographic. In addition to the Eidon, there's one place where instead of me, he writes it this way. And the use of this diphthong, well, what we call diphthong, to represent the epsilon also is very common in throughout the history, the early history of Greek, because even today in modern Greek, that combination of vowels is pronounced just like the epsilon. There are some obvious scribal errors that have been corrected, several transpositions, as I mentioned, the omission of that adverb eide, and so on. None of these seems to affect the sense of the passage. And when you look at the whole document and you try to get a sense for its text type, that is the pattern of readings, you find that it's very close, not identical by any means, but very close to the so-called Alexandrian text type. The other one, Papyrus 75, which may be as old as Papyrus 66, maybe even older, when you go through the same passage, you find that there are only about a dozen variations instead of two dozen, and half of those, again, are orthographic. The text of 75 is very, very close to that of Codex Vaticanus, and when Papyrus 75 was discovered, it was generally recognized to be a quite remarkable confirmation of at least part of the theories that Westcott and Hort had developed, because when they argued that Codex Vaticanus, especially when it agrees with Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus represents the most ancient form of the text, and there were people who didn't believe it, and they sometimes argued that no, this Alexandrian text type represents some kind of later revision in Egypt. And now, all of a sudden, you find a document that's a century and a half earlier than Vaticanus, and its basic text shape is the same. Not identical, one more time, I need to emphasize that. The differences are sufficient that they really require some kind of revising of the whole theory of textual development. But some of the more important features of the theory of Westcott and Hort were indeed confirmed by the discovery of Papyrus 75 especially. Well, I have a little bit of other data here, but I want to leave you on the edge of your seat about textual criticism, so I'll stop there. Let me just comment on something else in preparation for your assignment for next week, particularly with regard to the outlining of the gospel. Try to think of this assignment not at all as coming up with a table of contents. I don't want, at least not primarily, this obviously you have to include this, but I don't want it to be primarily a listing of events or some kind of guide to, you know, what is found in a particular chapter. What I would like for you to try to be thinking about is what is the basic structure of the gospel, and you know, by coming up with a few major headings, can I somehow indicate my own sense of the way the gospel is put together, what seems to be the flow of the narrative. And if you can come up with headings that help you see that progression of the narrative, that's really very helpful. Don't try to come up with a very detailed outline, and especially don't try to come up with an outline that has a very large number of major headings, because if you have lots of these, then you can't really quite get a sense for the basic shape of the document. Try to come up with 2, 3, 4 at the most, and then you can have subdivisions that again indicate how you perceive the material is being put together. Can somebody looking at your outline, can they see that the argument of the book is going somewhere? You know, think of it in those terms, that they can get a sense of what each specific minor section of the book is doing there. How does it seem to be contributing to the development of the narrative? Don't spend, you know, a great deal of time on it. I am more concerned that you go through the exercise of thinking along these lines. As I said, you're not going to be graded on this, but I would just like for you to at least make the effort of coming up with your own outline, your own impression of the structure of how the various parts of the book relate to each other. And then in class, I'll give you my outline and try to justify why I have done it a particular way. Keep in mind that the kind of outline that I have in mind, there isn't any one right outline, okay? That in a sense, these outlines are an expression of your own interpretation of the text. And so several different outlines can give different perspectives that can be useful in making good sense of the narrative.